Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Jem Duduku, who is a historian who has turned his expertise to the world of Hollywood and cinema in a new book called Hollywood and History: What the Movies Get Wrong from the Ancient Greeks to Vietnam. It's a fascinating read full of factual information which takes aim at the cliches that we get so used to in cinema. And the thing is, most people learn their history from films and culture, and they learn about the world from films and culture. So when films and culture replicate certain lies or certain fabrications or myths, then it is extremely powerful. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, to subscribe. You can leave a review. That really helps. Reviews are read by people. Tell your friends. You know, write them a letter. Use carrier pigeon, semaphore, smoke signals, anything that works. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty, or what was formerly Twitter. And you do all that. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation. But yeah, it's funny, these online relationships. I got quite a few. There's yourself, Kai Ross, who I've sort of interacted with for a long time, Andy English I interact with for ages. And then occasionally you actually meet people. Sometimes I'm walking down, I mean, it happens four or five times in Cannes this year that someone comes up to me and goes, oh, we follow each other on Twitter and we've talked on Twitter and stuff. And it's like, oh, great. Hi. I mean, I hope we haven't had any contretemps.
Yeah, it's the modern world. I mean, obviously you do a podcast, I do a podcast. So 25 years ago, there was no way to perhaps share this love other than through traditional media. So there is this kind of democratization. Obviously, it isn't quite as simple as that, but it's a brave new world out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got to accentuate the positive, etc., as the song goes. So
I do like the fact that, well, the people I was talking about, you know, Kai Ross has got a podcast about The Prisoner that I listen to. You've got Condensed Histories that I listen to. So it's good to have those sort of conversations of those voices. Your podcast is very snappily produced. It puts my sort of like taking out the occasional and ah to shame. You know, you've got it. I mean, you really sort of used audio in a really interesting way.
Well, that's Greg. It pays to have a producer. I mean, not that Greg actually I pay. We do it together. But and I do like, you know, I'm a regular listener to yours, and it really amuses me when somebody says something off key and they go, "Oh, well, can you edit that out?" And you say, "Oh yeah, yeah, sure." And if you listen to it regularly, you know it's going to stay in. So I'm aware of that. I'm going to watch myself. Okay.
All of this is going in.
Yeah, of course it is.
None of this is getting edited out. So when did you start the podcast?
Probably 9 years ago, and actually before COVID, it was quite different. It was actually so. I met Greg, like you, online. We seem to have similar tastes, similar ideas. His day job, if you like, is he's an entertainer. He used to do sort of a fun, silly reenactments for kids. He does magic shows, all kinds of things. But he's a live performer. Things like Stately Homes. If you sort of walk around, there's somebody standing there, I don't know, doing some juggling or something like that. That'll be Greg, or maybe it's Greg. And so we got talking, and then we ended up creating the podcast. And originally it was like, we'll pick a topic and we'll come at it from two different directions. And a lot of people were saying it's like sitting in a pub listening to two mates having a chat, which was exactly what we were going for. And then we just changed the format after COVID. He kind of wanted to take a step behind for various reasons. And I said, I still want to keep doing it. And he's constantly upped his game in terms of the editing side of things. That's certainly not what his background was. And yeah, the thing is, though, as you know, you do the raw audio and then you go back and carefully edit it. But if somebody else is editing it, you're not quite sure what they're going to do. And, you know, he sometimes puts, I make reference to a movie and he'll actually put in, you know, the soundbite from the movie, and it just really elevates the whole thing. So big shout out to Greg.
My experience of that is restricted to I guest occasionally on The Economist's podcast, The Intelligence, which is a brilliant high production podcast, and they basically it'll usually be linked to an article I'll have written, and they'll prepare like a little script, but they'll say, don't read the script, just these are the talking points. And then they'll ask me some feeder questions, but I've got so used to it that I'll just ramble. And then I'll listen to it back, and they've just, as you say, they put in loads of great clips and loads of great sounds and stuff, and it just sounds like I know what I'm talking about. It's magic.
Yes, always make sure you keep the editor on the side, because they can also make you look bad too.
Where has this fascination come from with, you know, with history movies in particular, with that sort of, because it seems to be your subject of choice, and the subject of your book is how Hollywood treats history.
Well, the reality is it's the same as everybody else. I grew up watching movies. Who doesn't? And when you're a little kid, watching something like Where Eagles Dare, which is an amazing, fun blockbuster type movie from the 1960s, you're sitting there going, well, I know World War II happened, and they seem to be wearing the right uniforms, and you just take for granted that Where Eagles Dare is as real as D-Day. And then when you're older, you realize all made up, none of that happened whatsoever. And, you know, I'm sure we'll go into it, but I think Where Eagles Dare is an example of, if you're a grown-up, you know at no point is it trying to replicate moments from World War II, and therefore I will give it a pass. It's pure entertainment with a historical dress-up. But there are other times when movies start flashing dates up and things like that, and it looks like they've done their homework, and it's no more historically accurate than Where Eagles Dare. And I don't like those sorts of films, because you have to read a history book to realize none of this happened, or it didn't happen this way, if you like. So like everybody else, I grew up watching movies, and I'm one of the few people. So for the overseas listeners, at 16, you have to take exams in Britain. They're called GCSEs. And I'm one of the last generations to actually have a GCSE in medieval history. So none of this modern rubbish. Now, let's talk about William the Conqueror and stuff like that. So I've just always had a fascination with it. The thing my mother noticed that I had a thing for history, because every time we went to the British Museum on like school trips, I would always come back with the same thing. It might be a jigsaw, it might be a puzzle, but it was always the Sutton Hoo helmet. And I still, anytime I'm at the British Museum, I always sort of pay my respects, because I just think it's just such a fascinating item.
Wasn't that, like, it was used as a sort of beginning of a history program or something? Because I always, that image, or maybe it was discovered while I was a kid, but because that image is seared into my head of that, of that helmet as being a, you know, a touchstone of, when people talk about history, that's one of the things I see, that and Stonehenge, and, you know.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about films which, you know, use history as a kind of playground to, you know, you're basically watching, like Bridgerton say, you're watching modern day stories but dressed up in period costume. The films that you talk about that purport to tell the true story of what actually happened, those are the ones that I particularly dislike, not the ones that it's that sort of revisionist. Like, I remember King Arthur was filmed in a, but this is the actual story. And it was like, this is no more the actual story than Excalibur was the actual story.
Yeah, exactly. So In the book, quick plug to everybody. It's coming out in September. You can pre-order it now. It's called Hollywood and History by Jem Dadoochu, but they all have to have that subtitle, which is what the movies get wrong from the ancient Greeks to Vietnam. So I do a broad brushstroke of history there. And of course, I can't put all the movies in it. But right at the beginning, I say there's sort of three types of movies that get it wrong for certain reasons. And the three movies I pick are 300, you know, the Spartans movie, Braveheart, and Hero, the Chinese produced movie. And the reason why 300 gets it wrong is because it's based on a comic, which was inspired by a 60s movie, which was inspired by real history. So that's a lot of filters. So the fact that in 300, you've got slow-mo, you've got literal monsters in it, nobody can watch 300 and think, I'm watching a documentary. So it's wearing its entertainment value on its sleeve, if they wore sleeves. And it's got the surprising thing about 300 is the chain of events is pretty accurate, but it didn't look like that. The motivations were very different, so on and so forth. And, you know, it's problematic in all kinds of reasons, but so were the Spartans. So that's one which, that sort of movie, I'll give a pass, like Gladiator as well. But then Braveheart is the one that is a classic example of one that I and many other historians have taken real issues with. And talking to Greg about this, he made the very valid point that it was made in the late 1990s, just before the internet. And so if Braveheart was made today, there would be so many reaction videos to it going, well, this is what the real history was, that Braveheart would never have been nominated for Oscars. And this is the thing, it won Oscars. It was seen as a prestige project at the time. And I'm not taking anything away from it. If it was set on Tatooine, you would just say, this is a great movie. You know, it's got goodies, it's got baddies, a ragtag bunch of rebels against an evil king. All of that works perfectly in the storytelling character arcs and narrative structure. Perfect. No notes. But the first thing it flashes up is Scotland 1280. And you see that Scotland's been taken over by the English. And it's like, well, that's news to me, because the Scottish king in 1280, Alexander III, was still alive. You know, it would have cost them no money whatsoever to have put something like 1285, for example. So instantly, from a historical perspective, it's like, this is totally wrong. And everything in the movie is wrong. Everything. And the few things that actually happened in history that are portrayed in the movie didn't happen like that. For example, the first battle, which was really a genuine victory for the Scottish against the English, the Battle of Stirling Bridge, is in the middle of a field. The clever thing about it was the Scottish allowed part of the much larger English army to go across the narrow Stirling Bridge and then attack them while they're out of order and most of their forces were on the wrong side of the river. This is a sign of how intelligent and smart the Scottish forces were. But according to Mel Gibson, it was about who could do the most shoving in the middle of a field whilst wearing a kilt, which I feel obliged to say didn't exist in the 1200s. So, you know, so that one, it's just like, it's trying to be a prestige project, but it's just as cartoony as the first. And then the third one, something like Hero. And Hero was a really interesting one for me because I walked out of Hero. It's one of the most beautiful movies I think you're ever going to see. And I knew vaguely about the first emperor of China, and there was an assassination, quite a famous assassination attempt by a musician who, and I love this, it's just this one line in the Chronicles which said he was attacked with a weaponized lute. How the lute, the musical instrument, was weaponized, we don't know, but he was tooled up. That's it. So, you know, like three lines from a chronicle from over 2,000 years ago is extrapolated into a movie. It is a gorgeous movie, amazing wuxia, martial arts, all this stuff, tick, 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 tick. But I walked out of the movie going, clearly the message in this is China needs a strong leader, because spoiler for the end of Hero, the assassin's about to get the emperor, and the emperor goes, well, no, if I die, everything goes to chaos. So you need me to keep everybody working. And it doesn't take a genius to work out that this is clearly a dotted line to the communist Chinese Communist Party. And like, you need strong leaders to keep China from sliding into chaos. But when it first came out, everybody, including The Guardian, was kind of so enamored by the visuals, nobody spotted the rather unsavory politics. And it took months for the Western media to go, hang on. So, you know, you do get this political interference, you know, not just in Chinese stuff, but, you know, all countries at certain times in their history have had governmental political movies. And one that I give an example of is Henry V was filmed by Laurence Olivier during World War II. Now, Henry V was fighting the French in France, but it was very much repurposed to imply we're going back to France to beat the Germans this time round. Interestingly, they had to film it in Ireland because they needed lots of young men, and England was kind of shy of them, and Ireland was neutral in World War II. So I'd say that those are the three types of, you can pretty much take any historical movie and drop them into any of those three areas.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, one thing that strikes me as well is how important the creators are in that, you know, I mean, how important contemporary reality is when you're looking at something in the past. So with Frank Miller having and Zack Snyder having 300, Frank Miller's is quite outspoken in his right wing sort of views. And like, for instance, one of the things that I found, I mean, one of the things that drama does to history is it renders lots of people invisible, you know?
Oh, and hugely, yeah.
And so all the you know, the 300 counts the 300 warriors, but not the auxiliaries who were slaves. So there were actually, you know, several hundred people behind the 300 who were, you know, facilitating them being part of it, but just weren't counted because as far as the Spartans were concerned, they weren't human beings.
Well, absolutely. And to add to that and sort of reinforce it, from a historical perspective, I don't know if you're aware of this or your listeners are, but there is this conversation, this almost sort of philosophical conversation about history, saying that really, history is, to understand really big impacts to history, it's social history. It's the slow changes of things like agriculture, civilization, education. And these are all really important. And that's considered left-wing history. And then right-wing history is great man history. So you have somebody fighting a battle or conquering a thing, and we focus in on that individual. And actually, it's very, very rare that a battle changes anything, really. The amount of time, if you just go onto Wikipedia, you'll read sort of like decisive battle. And then you realize 3 months later, there was another decisive battle. Well, it couldn't have been very decisive if they're still fighting, for example. So, but the interesting thing is, whereas Hollywood, we can say, is quite liberal in its outlook, it's quite right wing with the history because they like a great man in inverted commas. And the reality is, you will never get a blockbuster. I mean, Oppenheimer is probably the closest you can get to this, but nobody is going to make a 3-hour epic of Karl Marx writing Das Kapital, you know, no matter how important it was for 19th and 20th century history. Nobody's going to sit there and watch that. Well, I mean, the three people who do are the ones who buy the socialist worker anyway. So, you know, you're not going to make your money back on that one. And which is why I give sort of 10 to Oppenheimer. It's a shame it came out after the book was published, that, you know, Nolan managed to convince millions of people to go and watch a 3-hour talky thing with some pretty complex mathematics and physics in it as well. And I'm so happy about that because It's been a while, and I'm sorry to go off on a tangent here, John, but
I love these tangents.
So there's been this big conversation about what's happening to the Oscars. How can we make the Oscars relevant again?
Right.
And I really think that I watched this really well-researched video on YouTube, actually, saying, well, if, look at the 1970s, and you get something like The Godfather, which, and this is another thing, the gangster movies usually are historical epics, but we don't call them that. The Godfather came out in the 1970s, and it's about the 1940s. It's about the men returning home for after World War II. That is a different generation. Mm. You know, they are wearing costumes. We don't call it a costume drama, but that's exactly what it is.
Chinatown, so, but the thing is,
Exactly. So it is interesting how much history is put on the screen almost by stealth. It's like, no, really, it is history. But anyway, but the thing is, Godfather cleaned up at the Oscars, but also cleaned up at the box office. So anybody tuning in to see the Oscars in that year had seen it. But then fast forward 40 years and you get something like The Shape of Water, which is a good film, but I think it grossed in the American box office something like $30 million. Nobody went to see it. And so we need some, you know, Gladiator is probably the last time you have a lot. It earned a lot of money. It got a lot of prestige and it won a load of golden statues. So I hope that Oppenheimer pulls off the same thing, because it's a reminder that we are kind of fed up of super. I like a good superhero movie, but there's an awful lot of bad superhero movies out at the moment. And, you know, what Oppenheimer proves is people are willing to look at intelligent adult drama. But a lot of that has now been turned into miniseries on Netflix or HBO or what have you. So, you know, that's the problem there. But hopefully we're going to start seeing, is this a quirk or is this a bit of a return trend? I'm hopeful for the Napoleon movie, you know, Ridley Scott.
Very hopeful.
But, you know, But I also happen to know that Joaquin Phoenix is the same age roughly as Napoleon at Waterloo. So showing, you know, the problem with the actor is he can't change his age. So seeing him in 1793, it's like, mate, you are way too old. You are decades too old to be playing Napoleon at that point.
I'm not gonna worry too much about that.
There's only so much you can do.
Yeah, exactly. But I am going to push back on another point, which was your idea of no one's going to do a 3-hour movie about, you know, deconstructing the big man other than sort of Nolan with Oppenheimer. David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, that was back at the time when this stuff was big money. I'm talking about now. So, but because
that concept that Hollywood per se won't. I mean, because it's like almost let's bring in the big guns. It's almost like Shakespeare has this problem where it's like, I'm fascinated by kings and the terrible things they do, but is drama authoritarian in the sense, is drama always looking for one simplistic character that I can follow rather than looking at the complexity and nuances of vast social movements? You know, like Coriolanus is I think almost like a debate of that it's like, can I look at this in a more democratic way? I mean, I'm not claiming that William Shakespeare was necessarily democratic. I kind of think he was, but not in a way, I don't mean it in a sort of parliamentary political way. I mean it in a sort of, he wanted to hear all the voices. Is there something, you know, about drama that just drives us towards tyrants?
I think the answer is yes. You know, you need, for a good story, you need a beginning, middle, and end, and you need to hook it onto somebody. So that central character either is the person who beats the tyrant or becomes the tyrant. Godfather, for example. And that's, if you like, that is that you've hit on the fundamental problem of any time people do something about history. It needs to have a beginning, middle, end, a character arc, a rise and fall, the second act challenge, all that kind of good stuff. And that makes a great drama. That is not how life works, ever. You know, people are, everybody's life is messy and inconsequential. And I mean, the other thing, just to really boil it up as well, is I've heard you talk about this before. Social media isn't the real world. It's a heightened reality, both on the left and on the right as well. But the amount of times I'm seeing people having hot takes about history, and the problem is, hopefully everybody would agree. Overall, again, there's always exceptions to this stuff, but overall, if you look at the last 150 years, particularly in the West, things have become more inclusive, more democratic, more reasonable. 150 years ago, women couldn't vote. Now, around the world, there's been multiple national leaders who are women. You know, 150 years ago in Britain, you would have been arrested and put in prison for being gay. You can now get married. You know, so you, hopefully we can see that there is a progression of social justice as we moved through time. But of course, with history, we're going the other way. So just sort of turning around and saying, oh, Napoleon was racist. Yeah, but everybody was in 1800. And that's not what he's famous for. His racism is not what defined his story. Or you get people going, well, you do know that George Washington had slaves. Again, yeah, everybody did back then. So it's like sort of... There is a generation who are so willing to take the hot takes and to be so reductive that there's a part of me worried that history works on nuance. And let's take a sort of sacred cow in Britain, you know, Winston Churchill. You know, if you want to create an argument that this was a right-wing imperialist racist, that's there, you know, that's absolutely there. But if you want to talk about the man who saved Britain from invasion and galvanized a defeated country, that's there too. You know, this is the man who lost a general election in 1945 to the Labour Party. It's, and he did feel, and I hear where he's coming from, it's like, just won you a war, what more can I do for you guys? But also people were waiting, wanted a peacetime leader, not a wartime leader. So the thing about history, if you ask any historian, they're going to say the same thing on any topic. It's more complicated than that. But if you've got 2 hours, you can't get complicated. He's bad, she's good, and there's a big battle at the end.
Yeah, and there's a certain glamour as well that comes with just the fact that it's a movie star playing the role. You know, you just you give you know, there's a song by Bongwater that says it's easy to accept Jesus Christ as your personal savior when he looks like Willem Dafoe. I mean, I'm not necessarily suggesting that that's necessarily a history film, but it kind of is. I mean, that's the thing. You know, Jim Caviezel is playing a historic character right now in a film, or a contemporary character, actually, in a film, you know, the Sound of Freedom, I think it's called.
Sound of Freedom, yeah.
And he brings his good looks to the part and his bonkers ideas. But the same is true of so many characters where you're thinking, you can list the actors who have played Adolf Hitler, and they're pretty much all much more handsome than Adolf Hitler ever was in reality.
Well, I absolutely hear you. The one that popped into my head at that point was, of course, we've got Cleopatra. Yeah, and of course, you know, she's the big beauty. She's one of the most famous queens of, although technically a pharaoh, of history. And you've had multiple largely white women playing Cleopatra. Now, recently on Netflix, they've had a black woman play it, and all historians and Egypt agree she wasn't black. But anyway, that's a different thing. But, you know, today you would at the very least get an Egyptian woman to play her. Henry VIII, a lot of them are a lot fitter than the real guy. So of course these are Hollywood heroes with perfect skin and perfect teeth, and nobody has. I love this fact. It was Julius Caesar who invented the comb over.
No way. Terry Nuttall should play him.
Yes, and also, you know, the laurels you see resting on his head,
though,
before him they were round his neck, so again he had that round his to sort of hide his widow's peak. So this is all but you don't tend to get hugely balding men playing Julius Caesar. They all have luscious heads of hair, so you know, it's, of course, to be completely historically accurate is folly. Okay, so the one thing, again, going back to Mel Gibson with Passion of the Christ, is he did it all in Aramaic, a dead language. Same with Apocalypto. So, you know, if we were going to do Henry V, we wouldn't do it in Shakespearean language. We would do it in Chaucer English, and everybody would be sitting there going, "What?" Because we don't talk even remotely like Chaucer did nowadays. So, you know, how realistic can you make it? The answer is it's always folly. It's like trying to film inside a medieval castle with only candles. You need to go back to Stanley Kubrick and Barry Lyndon, where he nicked those NASA lenses because they could film in low light. It's like, well, not everybody has those NASA lenses. So it's almost like you're on a fool's errand to make it completely historically accurate. But what's your angle? What's your agenda is something that I would always like to know. And the thing that I sort of spoiler, if you like, so this ended up with an American publisher. This is the first time.
Spoiler for the book or spoiler for a film?
Spoiler for the book. So the book. Okay. well, I mean, vaguely spoiler for films, but it's fine. I wrote the book and presented it to them, and they said, you need to have a chapter on civil rights history movies. Mm. And I said, I'm a white guy in England. I don't feel particularly comfortable. And they basically said, it would look worse if you didn't. Right. So I sat down and watched a whole bunch of movies there. And I'm glad I did, because the spoiler is, the most historically accurate movies in the book, it isn't the ancient world, it isn't medieval world, it isn't World War II, it's these movies about the civil rights movement. And I think not all of them.
Not Mississippi Burning, surely.
Mississippi Burning's in it. Right. And also so's Hidden Figures as well in the thing. But if you look at things like Judas and the Black Messiah, if you look at Detroit, if you look at Selma or Black Klansman, the difference between all of those movies and anything else in the book is that, apart from Detroit, these are made by black filmmakers. There is an, it's within living memory, but also there is an earnestness there. There's a real feeling that we owe it to people to get it right. Whereas in the case of Gladiator, it's like, let's have fun. And at no point do they ever do that in that area. And therefore it does create this whole genre of really historically accurate movies. And I couldn't believe it when I was doing the research, but Selma, which came out in 2014, is the first Hollywood movie to be a biopic about Martin Luther King. That was so it was so counterintuitive. I treble checked it. It's like, has there not been? No, there has never been a historical. There's been lots of documentaries about the man, and there's been some very low budget sort of like art house films, but Hollywood has never thought to give him the sort of the Lawrence of Arabia treatment before.
Jeepers creepers. That's so astonishing. I mean, the closest you have to that is obviously Malcolm X by Spike Lee. And I remember during an interview, Spike Lee gave, there's a line that Danny Aiello says. He plays a police chief and he's arrested Malcolm X. And they say, sort of look out the window, and there's a whole line of people, and he releases Malcolm X because of, to avoid any further thing. And he says the line, no man should have that amount of power. And Spike Lee said, I wanted him to say, no black man should have that amount of power. But that's not what he said. He said, no man should have that power. So that's what I stuck to. And I just thought it was really interesting that Spike Lee was holding himself to that degree of, because it would have been easy, who's going to say,
of course,
who's going to say anything, and it would have tracked. It almost sounds a little bit unusual that he doesn't say, no black man should have that power. But he says, nope, but that's what he said. So that's what the script says, and that's what Danny Aiello says.
And I think that also with the civil rights movies, and also when we go into Vietnam as well, that's the last chapter of the book, is I think, again, that's one of the strengths of America, in the sense that they are happy to spend millions and generate millions showing the bad side of their society. Mm. Whenever we start talking about beautiful films from China or Iran or something like that, these are governments that will never create their version of Platoon or Judas and the Black Messiah. According to them, their society is hunky-dory, they have won every war, and all their men are brave, etc., etc. And it's like, well, of course they were brave in certain circumstances, but I find it so heartening that in the West, we're willing to really pick over the dark side of our history, you know, 12 Years a Slave and other things as well. You've got Peterloo in Britain. If you were to make the equivalent of Peterloo in Russia right now, you're going to prison, simple as that. So I take my hat off to all of these harder watches. I mean, if you like, the one criticism I have of the civil rights movies is almost none of them end happily ever after. Okay, they are exhausting and draining, and quite frankly, sitting there watching one after another, you sort of stare at your finger. What's the point? I would like something a bit uplifting, and indeed, in that chapter, I finish with The Woman King and point out it's the least historically accurate of any of these other films. But it's like over 20 years, they've earned the right to now have a black Braveheart. Yeah. In essence, and you know, this one is clearly let's have fun with it, and obviously the fact that it's a cast of African Americans, there's a sort of lesbian subplot in one of them. These are obviously very modern, but if you ran the same plot, had the same scenes, but made everybody white, this could have been out in 1965. You know, it's actually quite an old-fashioned traditional movie, and I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah, absolutely. You should be able to have fun with stuff as well as, you know, getting away from a sort of ghetto of, as you say, sort of earnestness, because that's what it's a little bit like there was a period where every gay film had to be tortured. You couldn't have someone just being happy like in Bros, you know, which has its own anxieties, but isn't Brokeback Mountain, let's say. One of the other things that I wanted to bring up in terms of what you were just saying about how, you know, it relates to a similar idea where things matter and people have to get it right. There's a sort of moral imperative to get it right, is looking at the Holocaust. Because when you look at Where Eagles Dare, you can just have fun with it and no one really gives a damn. And it's Clint Eastwood firing a machine gun around the corner. That's the stuff you remember. But when it comes to Schindler's List and Life is Beautiful, The Diary of Anne Frank, The Pianist, all books that you feature, then the stakes are considerably higher. What's your take on that in terms of how realistic those films are and how realistic those films have to be?
Well, I think you made the point yourself. We are in the same territory as those civil rights movement type movies. To do anything other than get it right would be a gross disservice. I mean, I'm trying to find the word. I think a movie that plays fast and loose with the Holocaust probably would be something that might end up being banned. You know, there would be a movement against it, and I would be completely 100% with it. A lot of these movies I hadn't seen for ages and watched again, or went back to, or I thought I knew really, really well, so I just wrote about it, something like Braveheart. I kind of know like the back of my hand. But going back, you know, Schindler's List is not something that you think, hey, it's Saturday night, let's get a pizza and watch Schindler's List. And my youngest son also really wanted to see it. His goal is to see, I think, the top 50 of the IMDb top, they got the 250, and he wants to see as many of those as possible. Yeah. And he goes, I still haven't seen Schindler's List, and it's in the top 10. It's like, kid, you know, unlike other heavy dramas, all of this happened. And you just sit there and you realize, and I remember the interview that Spielberg made going, you cannot show the whole Holocaust. It's just so overwhelming. It's unfilmable. So he said, I put the Holocaust on one side of a wall. I put the viewer on the other side of the wall, and I drilled a hole and you can peek through. And watching it again, I think the real genius of it is it's watchable. It is not overwhelming. It is harrowing. It is terrible in places, but there are also breathing points as well. And again, Ray Fiennes, you know, he could have just been a cackling madman and that would have fitted, but he made him at some times almost pathetic. And it's just a fascinating, it's one of the best character studies I've ever seen. Please, I in no way, like the guy, but it was, you know, he played it with 400 layers of subtlety and subtext, and it was all the more remarkable for it. So, of course, Tommy Lee Jones wins the Oscar for The Fugitive instead.
Well, they're never going to give an Oscar to a Nazi. You know, the Oscars are about aspiration. They're about what we want to see ourselves as rather than what we actually are. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And it's interesting that Ralph Fiennes obviously directs a version of Coriolanus, which again is that going back to that problem of how do we not glamorize something simply by the fact of making the spectacle out here. And I agree with you. I think the I was talking to someone recently and they told me that the actual eyewitnesses, the one thing they all said about I think it was Joseph McBride might have made this point. The one thing they said was Ralph Fiennes was too handsome as Gert.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
He was an abhorrent, you know, he was a really horrible looking guy. And as much as they uglied Fiennes up, they couldn't, you know, as fat as his belly was and all the rest of it, they couldn't make him as gross as the guy actually was. I think you'll be really interested in Jonathan Glazer's Zone of Interest. Because I think it, in many ways, is a film which is not just about the Holocaust, but is also about how we look at the Holocaust. And I think it will make other Holocaust movies seem pretty small by comparison and pretty conventional by comparison in a way which is not good, which is good for the Zone of Interest and not necessarily, you know, I mean, it's a little bit like when Saving Private Ryan came out and it was like, okay, every war movie now has to compare to Saving Private Ryan. I think I have a real bugbear with Life is Beautiful. I love Roberto Benigni. I think he's a wonderful comic talent. His early films are brilliant, are beautiful. And I loved Life is Beautiful when I first watched it. But I've been working in the Italian education system, and it's a regular rewatch on the day of the day of remembrance for the Holocaust, Holocaust Day. And I think it's the worst possible example of a Holocaust movie because it's about forgetting the Holocaust. It's about not seeing the Holocaust. It's about pretending the Holocaust didn't happen to protect your child. And, you know, okay, so why are we doing Remembrance Day in schools then?
Look, I hear you. I think that where it turns into an interesting conversation is getting kids into these big subjects. So everything you've just said from an adult's perspective, yeah, 100%. Go watch The Pianist instead. But you know, you've got to get the kids in there. And if it isn't that, it's the boy in the striped pajamas. Get that one right. And in Britain, when they're explaining World War One, they'll invariably use Blackadder. Now, Blackadder 4 was a comedy. It was never meant to be used in history classes. They get everything wrong in Blackadder 4. Now, I love Blackadder. It's hilarious. But the point is, if at least it gets the kids starting to look at the subject, it is then the teacher's job to say, okay, that was fun, wasn't it, kids? Now let's tell you what actually happened. But what I'm seeing a lot of is like, okay, we've now done World War One. It's like, no, you haven't. They didn't spend all their time in trenches, for God's sake. Anyway, yeah, so that's a whole other thing. So, I hear you. And if you like, this is, I guess, going back to the podcast with condensed histories. Mm-hmm. I've had some people say, look, you clearly know the history. Why are you starting with pop culture? It's like, well, I'm trying to get people into it. Because if I do an episode just on the Crusades, that's going to turn off so many people. But if I start off with a thing, like a movie, like The Last Kingdom, then that sort of like gets people in. And then I sort of sneak it in, and then I almost gaslight them with the history at the back end of whatever's on that particular episode. And I think that that's really important. And that's the argument that a lot of filmmakers make as well. It's like, oh, this is a great starting point, but they don't believe it. They're just there. I mean, you get the earnest ones like Spielberg with Schindler's List and, Nolan with Oppenheimer. But, you know, the vast majority of them, it's like, I just want bums on seats. I just want to sell tickets, maybe get a golden thingy attached to it and play fast and play to the crowd. And it's like, do you know what? A lot of history is quite challenging. And because all history is about human beings,
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The reason why World War II, it seems to me, is so popular is because we can all agree the Nazis were bad. And if you say that they've got a point, I'm going to say we need to have a conversation. But anyway, but almost everything else, it's like, well, it's complicated. It's from different people's perspective. You know, Edward I, who is the bad guy in Braveheart, one of his other names, apart from Hammer of the Scots, was the Flower of Chivalry because he was seen as such a great diplomat around Europe. And before everything went wrong in Scotland, he came up with a really good idea to heal Scotland. It just didn't work. And so, you know, it's like with everybody, I just hate it when people turn it into black and white, because it is very rare in history to find anybody who's an out and out hero. And it's very rare in history to find somebody who's an out and out villain. And actually doing these character studies can be really interesting if they're done well, but most people are more interested in a big battle, a big epic love triangle with the, I don't know, the US Civil War as a background to it or something like that. And you know, a screenwriter wants to write a good drama. They don't want to do a documentary on the Taiping Rebellion in China.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I find interesting about someone like Christopher Nolan, because I really do feel he's someone who is much more, I mean, he's got his flaws. He's got his recurring themes that he seems to come back again. I mean, for instance, his version of the great man of history, it seems to be the idea of the big lie, that people can't know the truth. There has to be one big lie that governments and everybody covers. I have to live as a villain in order to be a hero, sort of thing with Batman. But also, you know,
I was gonna say, you're the first person to compare Bruce Wayne to Robert Oppenheimer. Well done you, John.
But I think it's a similar figure. I think
I hear you.
Insomnia, it's all about a cop who made a lie, and all of his cases will be thrown out if it's discovered. And so it's all about making one bad lie so that everything else, the moral position, it's a weird obsession he has. But he feels like, you know, Dunkirk, the end of Dunkirk. How did the guy die? Oh, he was brave. He died, you know, an act of bravery. No, he died in stupidity, an act of, you know, he's knocked over, but it was an accident, you know. You create the myth.
Well, on that point, I'll never... I hear you. I just have to interrupt for a moment.
Go ahead.
A friend of mine, who very pithy guy, during Britain's fighting in Afghanistan, pretty much every evening there was coverage of it. And, you know, sadly, another serviceman had died. And you quite often got reports from like their fellow servicemen talking about how great they were. And my friend just went, why have no arseholes died in Afghanistan? And you know, it's because... once they're dead, they're all heroes, okay? But maybe that guy just before he died was just the worst person, you know, sexist, racist. He was mucking around with a hand grenade and then he got shot. And it's sort of like, well, so, you know, that, you know, he was asking for it, but you can't say that to his mom.
Yeah. I mean, I got blocked once from, this is in the very, very early days of Twitter. And he was, Nick Frost was sort of, you know, tweeting something about all heroes, support our servicemen, everyone's heroes. And I was like, every single one of them? Because I've met some squaddies. I know some guys who are in the army. And, you know, there's kind of, you know, there's a mix, you know. And he blocked me instantly because that kind of, thinking back at that, as I say, it was the early days of the internet. I wouldn't send that card. You know, there's no point sending that sort of provocation days. So it's like, but let's talk about the war, the other war. You talk about the good war in terms of the Second World War and why it's so popular because of the, you know, the good war, the Steve Ambrose idea of who really sort of this second wave of Second World War movies he was a real influence on. But looking at Vietnam, which was a war that Hollywood for a long time, you know, with the exception of Green Beret and a fairly unwatchable film, The Green Berets, by the way, and Apocalypse Now, it didn't want to handle, didn't want to look at.
Yeah, so I mean, it took about 10 years for the studios to start seriously looking at it. But although what was interesting is, you know, during my research, there was the theory that Apocalypse Now took so long to get rolling, but before we even get to the epic actual filming in the Philippines, that there was a theory that, hey, maybe we could film it during the actual Vietnam War, which is an insane idea. I mean, you just cannot control a war. They're dangerous for a reason, notoriously so. And also, you get
the clue in the name, war.
Exactly. I believe there was a song about it too. But anyway, and then with Platoon, it had been kicking around for years. But what was interesting for me was that Oliver Stone had won an Oscar for, I've now just instantly forgotten
Midnight
the name
Express.
Of the prison drama. Thank you. Midnight Express. And then he does a dumb horror movie with Michael Caine where The Hand, and it's sort of like, why did you go from something so gritty? And then, of course, you're going to have Salvador and then Platoon. And it's like in the middle of that, there's this terrible Michael Caine horror movie. What? But hey, I hear he was doing a lot of drugs in the early 80s. So that might explain a lot. But Platoon was so influential with this whole boot camp thing for the young actors. And, you know, so that became just the standard thing to do. You know, by the time 10 years later, plus you get to Saving Private Ryan, they do exactly the same thing. They're still using Dale Dye as the main military expert in that situation, even though obviously he fought in Vietnam rather than World War II. So, and of course, the thing about Hollywood or any industry is once there's money, people go for it. So you get this slew of some good, some not so good Vietnam films in the late 1980s. You know, it starts with Platoon. It's got Full Metal Jacket, another classic. You got Hamburger Hill. You know, so there are and many, many more. Bat 21, I seem to remember. And of course, technically, First Blood Part. Rambo First Blood Part 2. Almost a nonsensical sentence there. But hey, that was a movie and a big hit. And of course, the classic line in that movie, for those three people who don't know what that was. So John Rambo is a Vietnam veteran. He comes back. And the first movie, First Blood, is actually a relatively thoughtful for a time. Look at the way we treated the Vietnam veterans when they came back from Vietnam. That had something to say. But in the second one, he goes back to Vietnam to get some of these prisoners of war that the evil Vietnamese have sort of still got for some unknown reason. And there's the classic line that the Americans just loved when that film came out, which was, do we get to win this time? As if, you know, America hadn't tried in the 1960s and 1970s to win the Vietnam War. But, you know, that Vietnam still continues today. You know, there are less movies about it, but it does still Defy Bloods, you know, and another one there, which you could kind of put into the sort of like the black social history element as well. So, you know, as I've already said, it's great to see such condemnation of the American experience in Vietnam. Again, sort of bringing my family into it. My eldest son, I showed him Platoon. I went, I think you need to see this film. And during the village scene, he just shouted out in disgust, this is not an army, this is a rabble. And it's like, that was the problem. And my uncle served in Vietnam. And I sat down and I'm half American. And, you know, so I've talked to him about the Vietnam experience, and we sat and watched together Full Metal Jacket, and I said at the end of it, what did you think? And he said there wasn't enough swearing. It's like, wow, okay, seeing it's wall to wall, okay, fine. But I then said, so what's the most accurate portrayal? And he goes, Apocalypse Now. He goes, it isn't actually about any one battle or anything like that, but if you want to know the sheer insanity of the situation, the sheer, you know, sort of lunacy of decisions and things like that, it's Apocalypse Now every day. And I ended up collecting his and some other colleagues' war memories, and I wanted to turn it into another history book. So we didn't actually say this at the beginning. Hi, everybody, to the end of the podcast. I don't tend to write film books. I write history books. And on this occasion, I've written one about history being portrayed in movies, which is why I get to talk to John, which is a pleasure, by the way. But anyway, I was planning on doing a history book about Vietnam. It didn't work out. So I ended up writing a Vietnam novel where pretty much everything in the novel happened to different guys. It's called Echoes. And it's one of these things where it's drama. It's drama. It has a beginning, middle, and end. Oh, I've done the three-act story arc and all that kind of good stuff, because you have to make it work as a book. But the sort of insane things that happened in the book genuinely happened. I had eyewitness reporting of this stuff. So, and you do get elements of that in, I mean, going back to Platoon, again, during the filming, after the village scene, both Dale Dye and Oliver Stone just walked off. They, you know, what they had done is not film something. They had recreated a crime scene, which both of them had clearly been in at some point, and it was just pretty overwhelming for them. Like with my uncle, you can see that this baggage you just carry for the rest of your life, whether you like it or not.
And yeah, Brian De Palma does the same with Casualties of War, which is another sort of
Michael J. Fox film.
Yeah, it wasn't, and Sean Penn as well. It wasn't very successful when it came out, and I think it destroyed him for a while. I think he really thought that was his masterpiece. That was the film he's very political, De Palma. People don't realize this, but he's a real political thinker. And I think he thought, this is the best I can do. And if you don't want it, I'm not sure I even want to make movies anymore. And, you know, after that, he made like The Untouchables, which he very much considered, you know, I'm doing a studio picture and I'm not, you know, don't necessarily have to put my heart into it.
Yeah. Oh, but do you know what? The Untouchables is in the book as well. Mm. And it's another example of, yes, there was Al Capone. Yes, there was Prohibition. And that's about all he got right. But is it an amazing film? I, you know, like everybody else, I love the stairwell scene at the end. It's just, you know, perfect cinema. You know, it never happened, and it certainly didn't happen as gloriously as that. But
I'm one of the few people who think Sean Connery deserves an Oscar for that as well. I think
his
performance is amazing. Enough of this running shit.
Yeah. And the whole, you know, that's the Chicago way speech. Yeah, it was. You know, again, like Gladiator, like 300, that was designed to entertain, and it gets a 5 out of 5 stars for me on the entertainment stakes. But please, for the love of God, do not try and learn 1920s American history from The Untouchables.
Here's a bit of a philosophical question. I mean, but when the Untouchables came out in the late 80s, I want to say.
Yeah.
The Untouchables had already been a TV series. It had been a comic book. It had been treated on film and television extensively. The people themselves who were involved, the characters themselves, had entered into the culture as icons, Elliot Ness, Al Capone. Is there a point at which films stop being about the history of what actually happened and sort of become more about the way things are being imagined, the way, you know, the impact that they've had on our culture? And those two things can be sort of interestingly separate things.
Look, you make a really valid point, and that's clearly there. I thought it was very weird that I don't know if you've seen the Kevin Costner Netflix movie The Highwayman, which is about Bonnie and Clyde,
right? Yeah.
which really felt to me like a rebuttal to the 1960s movie Bonnie and Clyde, which does get things wrong in it and is clearly written from a very specific perception, again mythologizing these people. You know, the gangster era of the 1920s and the cowboy era to America and probably to the rest of the world is a bit like our era of knights in shining armor, in the sense that cowboys existed, knights existed, and pretty much everything you've seen about them in movies is wrong for so many different reasons. We don't have time to go into it, but also those gangsters of the 20s, someone like Al Capone, it's a brand name. And I throw out this theory in the book that one of the reasons why history is so popular, my theory is because it's an IP that isn't owned by anybody. If I want to do a Batman movie, I got to be in Warner Brothers. But if I want to do a Hitler movie, and everybody's heard of Hitler, then I can just do it.
Recognizable IP, yeah.
Exactly. So I think, you know, gangsters and all those tropes, I think that's there. But I think that what would be brilliant is somebody doing a movie which sort of starts with the cliches and just peels them away, almost like a conversation with the person, and say that never happened. Now, there is a moment of that in Chaplin, the movie with Robert Downey Jr. and directed by Attenborough. And he talks about creating the tramp, and then the narrator goes, no, it didn't happen like that. And then it shows the hard graft he took to sort of like create the tramp outfit. And so there are flickers of that there. But what you just said is it's kind of philosophical, it's thoughtful. And if I'm going to give you $100 million to make a movie, I probably don't want philosophical and thoughtful. I want wham, bam. I want hot girls. I want, you know, last moment escapes, and I want blood everywhere. Thank you. Sorry. It's got to be PG-13. I want the hint of blood everywhere.
I think it's always funny when there are new cliches as well that come up with this thing. I mean, I was looking at an old film from the 60s. It was a film Richard Byrne did, or actually it might even be the 70s, about Tito. And it's called The Battle of... I can't remember the name. I think it's only available in like a Slavic language. I don't think it's even available in English. It's only available subtitled in English. And in this trailer, and I'm going to act it out, which is going to be perfect for an audio podcast.
Maybe I should describe it. Listen.
Yeah. You just, there's a bit where a guy runs and he's leading the battle, the assault up sort of across a field, and he's machine gunning, he might toss a grenade. And then he turns around and he sort of waves his arm like as a, like, come on, guys. And I thought, oh, that cliche has been so... now you wouldn't see that anymore. Now you wouldn't see the turnaround and waving people forward. What you would see now is the sort of marine-like two fist pumps and then two fingers.
The hand gestures.
You and you go there. Oh, look at that with the fingers to the eyes. And you see the same things. And you think, okay. I mean, it might be authentic, but it's become a cliche now. And another new cliche I've noticed is the I, Tonya style based on real events, really, you know, we're not kidding, you know, and that sort of disclaimer at the beginning, or this claim at the beginning, which says, you know, this is so incredible, but it's true. And those are, I'm a collector of those kind of tropes.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting one as well, that the, because I put into the book talking about the difference between based on a true story and inspired by a true story. And it's really to the point where what's the point? With based on, it means there is no law to it, but you assume that they've got the basic names, the basic events, you know, things are being condensed and moved around to make it actually a happy story, etc. And probably there's like three people are being amalgamated into just the friend or something. I get it. Okay. But inspired by means, okay, well, you could say that it doesn't say this at the beginning, but you could say Where Eagles Dare is inspired by World War II, in the sense that Germans attacked people, and that's the only thing that we are going to get right in this particular movie. It's weird. And again, sort of on the point of based on and inspired by, there's also this thing of like, what's a war movie? What's a period piece, a costume drama? Because if you're going to turn around and say, well, costume drama is people sitting in rooms talking in non-contemporary clothing, it's like, well, you've just described The Godfather, but nobody would describe The Godfather as a costume drama. And it's like, really, costume drama, the more I looked into it, seems to be acceptable code word for chick flick. It's a bunch of girls. It's probably historical Pride and Prejudice. Historical chick flick. And it's like, you're not doing Pride and Prejudice justice, because it's wittier and better written than a whole bunch of lesser gangster films, for example. And so there is this sort of coded inadvertent phrasing that happens. And your point there about these biases, I do think that if you go back in the day, when people were less cynical about their leaders, it was easier to have like the king in the car. King Arthur being a classic example. King Arthur was pure and Camelot was pure, and we would all buy it in 1955. But in 2023, we're all sitting there going, what's his angle? Is he a heroin dealer on the side or something? You know, so we just won't buy anybody being good anymore, which I'm going to say is a healthy attitude to have. But it does mean that suddenly these ideas, as you said, the Nolan, the big lie type thing becomes its own cliche. And sometimes people are trying to find these conspiracy theories in some pretty straightforward history as well. It's like, okay, that's a cute way of looking at it, but it didn't happen that way for many different reasons. And of course, you don't have, I have a very understanding family that after a historical movie, they know dad's going to go on a rant now. But you know, for everybody else, you do not have the pleasure of sitting there with a guy who sort of knows some stuff about the history going, well, actually, and that's something that I think Hollywood has to be careful with, because the amount of, I do not believe that Scottish independence was triggered by Braveheart, but it certainly got a lot of Scots very excited about Braveheart, to the point where they literally did a statue which looked like the Mel Gibson version of Braveheart rather than anything remotely close to what William Wallace would have looked like in the late 1200s. And I think Hollywood has to be a bit careful about this stuff. You don't know, if you're playing with somebody else's history, it could be a really emotive bit of history and you could have some unintended consequences from this. So you're playing with fire in these situations.
That's a really good point. It's a fascinating, it's almost like there should be content warning. You know, this is really, you know, if you want to go and read some more about this, go and check this out. Because that's the point is, you know, 90% of the audience won't be reading any books about this or going to get, they will base all they think of on a subject on the film, and they'd be like, oh, they were really bad, those people, and I didn't realize, I thought it was this way or that way. But let's go, there's one other film that I wanted to go back to, which I thought you, sure, you were, when we were talking about sort of how the media, a film can sort of attack another media version of history, and that film is Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood film back from 1992. Yeah. Which many people would see as a sort of revisionist Western. I would argue it is kind of half of a revisionist Western, and then it goes back to being a Western with a capital W. You know, so the first 8/10, let's say, is very, I'm being very precise here. But the minute he takes a drink, it's just, we're back in a Clint Eastwood. It could be the High Plains Drifter at that point, or Fistful of Dollars. He's just going to go around and shoot everybody, and that's fine. But we're in a generic space, which is different from the rest of the film. That would be my argument. And that's not necessarily a criticism either. It's just the way the film shifts. What do you think of Unforgiven?
Well, I think it's a stone cold classic, and yeah, he had the genius idea of basically saying, I mean, if you like, it's a bit of film history, referring to film history and also real history, which, yeah, you know, kind of blows your mind in the sense that this is him saying goodbye to all those Western characters, the man with no name, etc., that we have known Clint Eastwood for the previous 30, 40 years. So, you know, that's an amazing act in its own right. And it does get certain things quite accurate. Just one thing to watch out for, everybody, if you're pre-20th century and people are starting firing guns and they're really accurate, just to get super technical for a moment, a musket, the reason why they all stood in lines is because a metal tube, you get a bang, you get a little spherical pellet going down it. It's rattling down that big, long barrel, and so it flies off in loads of different directions. So that's why you need 50 guys to stand in a straight line, because they will hit something, maybe, if you've got 50 of them firing at the same time. Whereas with modern weapons, they are called rifles for a reason, because you've got these spirals of grooves in the barrel, so that when the bullet goes down, it doesn't ricochet off the sides and flies off in any different direction. It spins, so it stays in a straight line, so they become more accurate. So that's why a modern rifle is far more accurate than something from the 1850s. And so once you know that, and you know that all Western guns had just those metal tubes, no rifling in them, in like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, they're shooting hats off people's heads at, like, you know, 100 yards. That's just absolutely impossible. And what I like in Unforgiven is when they start shooting, they are close. You know, there is no chance for any sort of inaccuracy here, because they know how inaccurate their weapons are. But, you know, one of the other things I dug up when doing my research, about 25% of the Wild Frontier was black. And you do not see that in Unforgiven, and you certainly don't see that in a John Wayne film. Because, of course, after the U.S. Civil War, you had all these African-American men who wanted to make a new life, and the best place to do it, like the white guys, was to just do it on the frontier. You could earn quite a lot of money. 25%, and you do not see that.
And you would still have people complaining about Morgan Freeman being like a token black guy in the movie, whereas in fact, he's underrepresenting a black presence in the frontier.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, if you want to get technical, the horses were relatively small. So John Wayne and Clint Eastwood, both comfortably over 6 foot, were way too big to be riding those horses. 19th century horses, their feet would have been dragging along the ground. But you don't see that, do you?
My God. Yeah, I can see what you mean by you don't want to be too historically accurate at this point.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people smelling bad teeth, etc. You know, well, the other thing is that well done for Clint Eastwood to being that old in, let's say, 1870, because, again, life expectancy wasn't what it is nowadays. I've turned 50. I know you're in your early 50s yourself, John, you know, but I hopefully you'll agree with me. I don't feel 50. 50 to me when I was a kid, that's old. You know, yeah. You should be sitting in a rocking chair with a pipe. And it's like, no, I kind of want to still do things. So, you know, but 50 in 1870, you were riddled with arthritis and worms and everything else, which, again, you just never actually see in the movies.
But wait a second, Andrew. I want to go back to this thing about the rifling. When comes in? Because I mean,
it starts coming in the 1800s. There's a guy called there's a British engineer called Joseph Whitworth, and he created the legendary Whitworth rifle, which was used. First mainly in the U.S. Civil War because the British Army it was so expensive they didn't want it, so the Americans did it. But the amazing thing about it was that spinning thing he worked out. So literally the bullets were hexagonal. So you could see that if you wanted to change your entire army to hexagonal bullets, that would be quite cost prohibitive. So what the Confederates did is they bought Whitworth rifles and used soft lead. So as it went down the barrel, it actually became hexagonal. Very clever. But it means that a musket is accurate to about 100 yards. The Whitworth could be accurate up to 1,000 yards. And so that's where you get these sort of legendary sharpshooters of the Confederate Army. Now, that in no way, they were clever with guns. They were evil slavers, terrible. I'm not pro Confederacy, but this is one of these things where them's the facts.
Sure. And in that movie, Clint Eastwood is shooting the hats off people's heads and also cutting the rope of Tuco. And that's during the Civil War. I mean, so that could be okay.
Oh, no. Cause I love this. I watched, an ex US, Navy SEAL. I think it was, he was a sniper in the US Army and an elite one. And he said, look, you know, one of the biggest cliches you see in Westerns is that shooting of the noose and saving it. And he basically proved, when you think about it, it's quite simple. The rope is quite thick. A bullet is quite small. It's no wider than your finger. So one bullet is not enough to cut the rope. And basically he demonstrated it. And he was able to hit the rope. But he goes, the only way you could actually cut it is to hit twice right next to each other. And in his opinion, that was basically impossible. He tried for a whole afternoon with a modern rifle. He was unable to do it. And he goes, you know, it maybe once in a blue moon you get lucky and something like that happens. It's basically impossible. But, you know, thanks to Hollywood magic, by just all they do is they run a little piece of explosive tape in the middle of it and then just detonate it. And every time it cuts free and Tuco lives.
Oh, my childhood has been ruined.
this is what it's like talking to a historian. Sorry, John.
No, I love that. I love it because I love the facts and I love to know when something's generic and when something's factual. And there are sometimes when you can see a filmmaker is really fascinated by the history and is using history in a really interesting way to not be cliched, to escape the cliche, because reality does something weirder than you could ever think up. I remember reading David Simon talking about, I think it was his book on The Corner, which he did before The Wire. And he was talking about how when people fall down, when they're shot, it's a learned response because there's no
That's actually
need.
In Homicide, Life on the Streets.
Homicide, that's
I read
right.
that book.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I just love that idea. That's one I always use regularly when I'm talking, you know, fun fact. You know, unless you're hitting the in a fatal area or the knee, there's no reason for you to fall down because the bullet has passed through you and has really no sort of effect on your, you know, you weigh much heavier than it. And why would it throw you backwards? And why would you, you know, fall to the ground? Except you've seen it on TV.
Yeah, 100%. And also shotguns don't work that way. But I love a good John Woo movie, so I'll let it pass. So anytime you... Oh, the other one, and just to really annoy the listeners, is... silencers do not work like that. You want to talk about a cliche in movies, that little farty noise? They don't sound like that at all. They're actually what they are, tend to be called, is suppressors, because you can reduce the sound of one, but you cannot change the fact that the bullet is breaking the sound barrier. So you get that noise, you get the explosive charge, and then you get the crack of it coming out the front, and you can basically reduce one of those three, and so it's less loud, but it's still something like a stereo on full volume. You know, it's still loud. You know, you couldn't, like, my favorite silly example of this, I like a good John Wick movie, by the way, but in John Wick 2, when he and Common are sort of like walking along in this crowded way and they're sort of firing the silencers, everybody's oblivious to it because everyone be running screaming, but that never happens in any movies with silencers.
That's so good. That's such good knowledge. Listen, last question then. What's the thing that most annoys you, or even it could be a film, or it could be a trope that most annoys you, that films get wrong, and that you it's not just like, oh well, fair enough, it's a storytelling trope or whatever, but it really drives you mad.
Ooh, okay. That's such a good question, because there's so many. I think I'm actually going to go all the way back. It's like, if you're going to flash up names and locations and dates, get them right, or what's the point? It doesn't cost you any money to change the number on the screen, but as soon as it's wrong, it's like, I give up then. Or you get this in spy movies a lot. It's like, London, England, what, as opposed to London, Canada. I'm pretty sure I know where London is, you know, and the image there is obviously the famous one. So yeah, I'm going to say probably that. But if you want a super technical one, it's the chainmail problem. So basically, proper chainmail back in the medieval era isn't a very good armor on its own. So they had something called a gambeson. It was like a woolen padded tunic underneath it, shock absorber, basically. Mm. And they had the same thing over their head. And you keep seeing in the movies them with the chainmail onto their flesh. And it's like, that's going to give you zero protection, because if I hit you with anything, that metal will just bite into your head and it'll bleed everywhere. And of course, they knew that in the medieval era. So they had, but of course, you never see that because it looks ridiculous. It looks like they're wearing a crash helmet, which is kind of what you would want to wear in a battle. So yes, it's incorrect use of armor for the technical one.
Excellent. Brilliant. And conversely, what would be a film that you would point out and say, this is a great film and also technically, historically nails it? Even not necessarily even with the events, but just how things were in that time.
Well, because we've already mentioned a few of them. So
Say Master and Commander.
Master and Commander is very, very good. And we haven't mentioned it. So Master and Commander.
Yes.
There you go.
Knew it.
Yeah, it's really good. And do you know, one of the bits I love about that is the drummer boy, because it does show you that children were sometimes involved in these things because they were learning a craft in the sea, etc. And also the damage you get from the splinters. You know, you don't have to be hit by a cannonball to be in serious trouble on a ship. So, okay, that's a great one. And also, I'm going to say to this on the record, and John, I'm going to horrifically apologize. I only had so many movies I could put into the book, and there's no Terrence Malick, and I know what a huge fan you are of him. I am sorry, I just didn't have the space. It is like, I never got to the point where I needed to use one of his movies to make an argument, so I'm sorry. I am very sorry.
Thin Red Line is really accurate.
The Thin Red Line is very good. I have one issue with Thin Red Line, but I won't. Well, it's the bit when they're literally under fire and they're contemplating nature. It's like, I've spoken to veterans, and nobody, when they're under fire, has thought about philosophical questions. It's more a case of let's get the hell out of here.
Oh no, I will dispute that, because that's in the James Jones book. There's moments in the James Jones book where people are sort of that thing of having incredibly intense perception that you're focusing on stuff. And plus, the thing about the snake in the grass, so many people on Guadalcanal died of the poisonous snakes I think more than got killed by the bullets. The other thing I love about that is they all have yellow hand grenades, and that's because the rush to get them to the Second World War was such after Pearl Harbor that they only had training hand grenades, which were painted yellow because they're dangerous, and so you want it to be seen. But of course, in a combat situation, wanting to be seen is the last thing you want when you're going into an attack.
It's your podcast. You absolutely win on that one. But just one point there.
Go on.
It doesn't matter which battle in history or which war in history, you're always going to get more people dying from disease and these very unglamorous, unsexy things that don't work well in movies. So anytime they show things like wounds and injury, I mean, Born on the 4th of July, concentrating not on death, but on disability and injury and wounds. I always like seeing that, because you will get more people wounded, more people with dysentery and unsexy stuff like that than just being shot.
Even the Woody Harrelson death in Thin Red Line is remarkable.
Oh, that's a great one.
He just blows his ass off by grabbing the wrong part of the grenade to throw it. And he's kind of the first sort of character.
Proper casualty.
Yeah, exactly. So it's anyway, right. Very, very last question, which is, what film book would you recommend for our listeners?
Well, you've had so many great, great people on this, and they've said so many great books. So, what I'm going to do, like my book's a little bit adjacent, I'm going to be a little bit adjacent, and I'm going to recognize Harold Jahner's Aftermath, which is basically the story of Germany from 1945 to 1955, because I realized I knew nothing about that. And within that, yes, there's Reconstruction, but it talks about German art, German cinema, and things like that. There was a Truman film, which I'd never even heard of before, but apparently across the whole of Europe, there were these rubble movies after World War II. Mm. Sometimes they were romantic, sometimes they were contemplative about the nature of war, etc. Sometimes they were comedies, like Passport to Pimlico. So Harold Jahner's Aftermath is just really interesting about how art and films can be used for a country to describe what it's just been through, and sometimes be used as a sort of almost like a psychological crutch. Now, please just help me on this, John. What is the name of the man who plays Goldfinger?
Oh,
the actor.
Hortz. Buchold Hortz. Wait a sec, I'm going to be Googling this right
now. Okay, you Google that. Well, I'll explain why. Because he was an anti-Nazi. He was very much against the Nazis in World War II. But after World War II, he had a healthy career for about 5 years of playing
Gert Frobe.
Absolutely Gert Frobe.
Nothing like what I was saying. Hortz Buchold.
Apologies to Gert,
is in The Magnificent Seven.
Well, yeah, Gert Frobe spent about five or six years playing the returning German soldier in lots of really well-regarded movies. And yet we just think of him as the plump bad guy in a Bond movie.
Who doesn't even have his own voice in it. He's entirely dubbed. So, I don't expect you to talk, Mr. Bond. I expect you to die. Isn't even him, you know? Oh, I feel so sorry for those European actors who just give their presences but aren't, don't get any, A lot of actors, I mean, in Hollywood, it was quite common to just dub people. I mean, even like there's quite a few famous actresses who tend to get dubbed throughout their careers, especially their singing voice. I mean, one of the famous ones that I think is always lovely is Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
Where you see where you have that scene where Donna Reed is dubbing over
she's behind the curtain, isn't she?
Yeah,
and then they raise the curtain.
Exactly. That's a later one. But I'm thinking now I'm gonna have to Google her name as well. the actress who plays her nemesis. There you go. All this will be cut out, so no one will. Debbie Reynolds, sorry, not Jean Hagen plays Lena Lamont.
Right. Okay.
And so what happens is Debbie Reynolds is singing behind the curtain. Jean what did I just say?
Gene Kelly?
Gene Hagen is...
Oh, sorry, Gene Hagen. Sorry.
Gene Hagen is miming at the front. And when the curtain goes up, you see Debbie Reynolds, who's actually singing the song, but she's not. She's dubbed by someone else. So she's not singing the song. And the best thing is that earlier on, when there's a dialogue scene where she dubs over Lena Lamont's lines, Debbie Reynolds wasn't very good at it and couldn't do them very well. So you have Gene Hagen dubbing over her own lines, doing the posh version of Lena Lamont and the, you know, I can't stand him.
That's an amazing bit of that. Thank you for that, John. Oh, that's brilliant. But again, it's another historical movie that we don't consider historical because it was talking about silent moving to sound at a time when Hollywood was a generation on from that. So it is really interesting what we do and don't think of as actual history film. Unless it's got a king in it or it's like World War II, we don't tend to think of it as history. And yet history's everywhere, all types of things. I'll shut up now.
Brilliant. No, don't shut up, but we can continue talking without the recording because otherwise the listeners will throw things at me. But that's brilliant, Jem. Your book, Hollywood and History, What the Movies Get Wrong from the Ancient Greeks to Vietnam, Jem Duduchu,
pronunciation.
Duduchu, is available when?
It's available for pre-order as of recording. It's out early September.
Excellent. Brilliant. So as you hear this, you will be able to pre-order your copy. Thanks so much, Jem.
Pleasure.
So that was my conversation with Jem. It was really interesting. Some of those points, so just fascinating. I love the thing about The Silencer, which there's a new film by David Fincher called The Killer, which actually sort of brings up that point by using subsonic bullets as a way of silencing the weaponry in one scene and then sort of in another scene. Totally goes back to what you would imagine a movie about this would do. Okay, so thank you very much for joining me. Thank you to Elliot Atkins for the music, and thank you, dear listener. Talk to you next week.
Being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.